Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to Better Than Life, the episode-by-episode breakdown of Red Dwarf. I'm Fergus, and I've watched the show pretty much on a loop my whole life.
And I'm John. I haven't rewatched the show in decades, until now. We're all alone, more or less, because every episode we're joined by a professional joke wrangler and by Alex, producer and herder of cats. This time, we're talking about Series 1, Episode 1, The End, with Guy Kelly.
Let's get out there and twat it.
It's a show about a man who's lost 3 million years in space. His company an evolved cat and a hologram he hates. Plus a fuzzy robot and a ship that's gone senile. We love the jokes and sci-fi stuff, that's why it's better than life.
We have a treat of a guest to kick things off. He's a comedian, actor, writer. He hosts the internet's only husband and wife Garfield podcast. And he's a fan of Red Dwarf. It's only Guy Kelly.
It is. It's me. Hello. How are you doing? I am delighted to be here. Thank you so much for having me along.
Thank you for coming.
We're honoured. It's our first episode. We're covering the first episode of Red Dwarf, and you are here to help us with that. And that's a privilege for us.
Genuinely a bit thrilled. It's a privilege for me as well. Like, what an absolute treat. Lovely idea for a podcast. Looking forward to you recording more of these so I can listen to it.
Let's see how you get on. We can have you back on. So Red Dwarf, what level of fan are you? Like, if there's a scale that goes from, oh, I like him off the Britass Empire, through to technically Gelfs aren't aliens, where do you sit on that scale?
Much more towards the technically Gelfs aren't aliens. Obviously, they're genetically engineered life forms. The clue is in the name. My Red Dwarf sort of fandom journey, if one can call it that, has ebbed and flowed with time, as I think a lot of people's will have. It sort of picks up on it as a kid. It was sort of, broadcasting. I don't know when the first episode was broadcast. I watched it yesterday, but I couldn't tell you the broadcast date of it. But I sort of watched an episode of it when I felt like I was slightly too young to get it, and it terrified me. And then as I grew up a bit, stumbled across it on TV again. And it was only a couple of years later that I realized, oh, that terrifying thing that I saw was this silly sci-fi kickabout sitcom. Never want to do things in half measures. Signed up to the Red Dwarf fan club. So got the monthly Smegazine that
Smegazine
came out?
Yeah.
Proudly wore the watch where the wrist strap of that, the wristband said Smeghead. That was great. I've never cosplayed as anything from Red Dwarf, though occasionally when my hair gets longer, I do think that a sort of gold lamé jacket cosplaying as Ace Rimmer would be an absolute treat, just to be a swaggering arsehole.
How are you with the voice?
See, that's a tricky thing to do. I like to consider myself as being all right at sort of voices generally, but Chris Barry, as I'm sure we'll touch on, was a mimic. Like, his voice is incredible. That was effectively his background, because he was on Spitting Image before he came to Red Dwarf, I believe. I'd be too afraid to even try it at the fear that he'd just appear at my door and be like, no, that's not it.
Did you ever hear the audio records of the books, like Infinity Wealth and Scarf Drivers?
Absolutely.
He does all the voices, and he is, I mean, it's uncanny.
Yeah, it's magical. I mean, one of the notes I got from watching the first episode, which I'm sure we'll get to, is there's a bit where Rimmer mocks Lister, and he mocks him with Lister's voice. You're like, oh, this is so good.
Yeah, it is. It's an extraordinary thing. I think the premiere was February 1988. Were you in on the ground floor? Were you in right there, or was it?
I was. I'm but a wee slip of a lad. I was. How did you say 88 or 98?
88.
88. Then I was a wee slip of a lad. I was two.
That is too young for Red Dwarf.
And so yeah, I came to it much later. My first experience of Red Dwarf was coming downstairs, and I think either my parents were watching telly or had left the room with the TV on, and I'd been sent to bed, not through any misdeed. It's just you need to sleep as a child.
It's a horrible punishment.
And so, yeah, it was nighttime. I came downstairs. Something was on the TV, and it was, I later realised, the episode where Rimmer gets some sort of space hologram virus, and Mr. Flibble has terrible powers.
Quarantine is called.
Quarantine, yeah. That's it. Rimmer wears a pink gingham dress. Mr. Flibble, the little potato puppet? What? The penguin puppet, which I've got upstairs. Not the original, obviously, but I've got a Mr. Flibble upstairs.
You have a Mr. Flibble.
I've got a Mr. Flibble somewhere. And I remember that scaring the absolute piss out of me. I was terrified. It was this larger-than-life thing. It looked like a scene from hell. Like, if I sort of later on in life watched Event Horizon, I'd think, oh, I remember this bit from Event Horizon. Like, it occupied the same kind of horror for me, because it was this man, obviously completely round the bend, this nightmarish, shoddy penguin puppet that just radiated evil. And it terrified me. I don't recall whether I, like, ran away from it, but I certainly didn't continue watching it. And that stuck with me for a while as, like, quite a horrifying experience. I can't have been too old. I can't remember when that episode came. This is going to turn out like, yeah, I was 15 and just an idiot.
No, but you'd have been under 10, definitely, definitely. I want to say that would have been like 93, 94 maybe. Have you got it in front of you, Alex? On
1992.
92, oh, there you go.
But it was repeated, right? It might have been so repeated.
If I was six, I think it's acceptable to be scared witless by that at the age of six. Let's
I'd agree. There's a hell of a lot of crossover with that episode and Doctor Who stuff. Like, there's the German accented scientist with the melted face with red laser eyes in that same episode.
Oh god,
she was,
yeah,
extremely terrifying. But then I think we couldn't do that. Who'd clear up the mess is one of my favorite lines in all of in the whole show. So I'm not sure. So you were scared before you were amused. When did you find the
100%? Yeah.
Are you still, or did you find the funny in it eventually?
I've watched it since. I've conquered those demons.
Well done.
As I say, I own an instance of my tormentor in a box of stuff upstairs. But yeah, I don't remember when I came back to it, because I don't think at the time I'd registered that was Red Dwarf. That was just a scary thing that was on telly, and it was only years later when I must have stumbled across Quarantine at an age that I could have appreciated it, where I went, oh, hang on a minute. This is this nightmarish thing I remember watching.
Wow.
But yeah, it was a few years later. I must have been, I guess, around 9 or 10, I started getting into it. I've got a copy of the novel, or the omnibus of the novel, which is the one that I bought as a kid, and it's like battered and bruised, and the spine of it's been taped up several times. It's stained with the, you know, the sort of horrible toys that you can buy for children that's like a mesh bag with like goo in it, a rubber skin, and then just like staining, like something like that, or it had like skulls in it and that burst, and so part of the book is now stained red. So I really got into it, and it's been a thing that lasted a while, and I got like weirdly into, like I say, subscribing to the magazines and like hoovering up every episode that I could. Of course, around that time, there was no way of knowing which episodes I'd seen and which I hadn't, because we didn't have all the world's entertainment media at our fingertips.
You could kind of go by production value to an extent, couldn't you?
This is true.
Like, the worse the show looked, the earlier it was, right? That was a fairly simple trade-off they made with production design. Did you ever wear a black T-shirt that simply read, let's get out there and smeg it? Or actually, sorry,
let's get out there and twat it. No, but there was somebody, I was in an improv sort of actor, like a sort of youth theatre-y improv-y thing in Bedworth, which for those of you Midlands inclined will already send shivers down your spine. There was somebody there who had a let's get out there and twat it t-shirt. Over the past few weeks, I have been, God help me, looking on eBay for a don't shoot t-shirt that Lister wears.
But that's a cool t-shirt and a deep reference.
Right, that would be a deep
cut. That's not a quote. If you saw someone wearing a don't shoot t-shirt, you'd be like, yeah, cool tee, whether you knew it was Lister's original t-shirt or not. When I saw someone wearing a let's get out there and twat it t-shirt, part of me thought, yeah, cool tee, that means you're into Red Dwarf. Great, so am I. The other part of me thought, what do people who haven't seen Red Dwarf think that t-shirt is? What do you mean, let's?
Like, what are you trying to sell?
So was it that scariness that hooked you, or was it this kind of second loop around where you went, oh, it's funny too?
Yes, it was definitely the second loop. So when I first properly got into it, that was just watching it as a comedy sci-fi series. I was a fan of Douglas Adams, Hitchhiker's Guide, all that sort of thing. And it was like, oh, this is funny, but it's also good sci-fi.
Mm.
And that's something that I really sort of enjoy from it. Like when you can properly blend together two genres. This is just plugging a friend's thing now. I don't know if any of you have listened to The Sink, a comedy horror podcast from BBC Sounds.
It's on the list as of now.
That is comedy and horror in a way that the horror, or rather the comedy, doesn't sort of undercut the horror. It's not like, oh, we're laughing, it's a relief. It's like, oh, we're laughing, but things are still really bad. Mm. And Red Dwarf kind of did that with sci-fi and with comedy. I don't want to go on a huge tangent about the novelizations, but my God, if you're listening to this and you've somehow not read the Red Dwarf novelizations,
what are you doing?
Which would be wild to me. Like, I'm interested in Red Dwarf enough to listen to a podcast about it, but I'm not going to go through the ancillary media. That's an outrageous. What are you doing with your life? Stop.
That is a fault. That is a red flag.
It is. But the exploration in the novels, the sort of space to give the sci-fi room to breathe while still being funny and still having like a high gag rate per page and funny situations and sort of sparkly dialogue between the characters. And I think that's one thing that sort of cemented or deepened my interest in the series, sort of seeing these characters in a kind of more intricate way. Like, it's not just, we've got a cool sci-fi idea, we're going to run with it for 25 minutes and then we're on to the next thing. This is, here's one of these cool sci-fi ideas and we are going to pick it to the bone. We are going to explore the concept and work behind that. And that for me was just delicious. Like, I'm the sort of person that likes lore in things. It's why I can't play World of Warcraft, because I'll have to read every item description and I'll just die in my chair. And Red Dwarf for me was something like that. It sort of suggested a world. And I, like, one of my notes from writing this down yesterday, when we first meet Rimmer and Lister, you've got Lister singing from Ganymede and Titan, yes sir, I've been around. What a lovely bit of world building. Mm. There's folksy songs about visiting Galilean moons of Jupiter. Like, because of course there would be. And it's that's the kind of thing that really got me in. That's why I've still got the Red Dwarf Survival Guide upstairs. Haven't read it for 20 years, but it's like, oh, it's more of this world.
I mean, the books obviously replay moments from the series in more novelistic ways. So in a way, they're a sort of an alternative timeline, if you like. Are they canon to you, Guy? Are they your canon?
I think they are. Just because it's extra world building and it's extra detail, the finding out why Lister ended up on Red Dwarf, the sort of going into the detail, the backstory of his plan for Frankenstein, and it just deepens the characters and it gives a sort of a richness to the world that is there in the show, but I don't know, it makes everything feel bigger and feels sort of more lived in. Like, it's a sort of silly comparison, but like a thing I love about the first Alien film is the ship that they're in looks gross. It's dirty, the walls are scuffed, it's been built by the people who bid the lowest. Like, it's just workaday dull. It's not exciting that they're space truckers. And that's what Red Dwarf's got, with the added benefit of the sets are made out of like repainted tubes of toothpaste.
Did Doug Naylor and Rob Grant not cite Alien, in fact, for that whole truckers in space thing, that kind of,
oh, really?
Used universe thing? It does work. The production value on series one, let's be honest, it's not high. I'd buy it. I certainly believed it when I first saw it.
Oh, God, yeah. It's consistent enough, and it's sort of internally, it follows its own internal logic to the point where even, and I don't know if it's in the pilot or in one of the later episodes of season one, where there's a camera shot where you can just see part of the soundstage. Like the framing is above like whatever the eye line should be, and you can just see whatever studio lot they were in. But it doesn't take you out of it because the world is drab grey paint of infinite different hues and lusters. It is bits of piping hanging from the ceiling, and it's just, there's something sort of knockabout to it that just fits.
Yeah, it's constantly falling apart. It's worse than the Millennium Falcon. It looks rubbish. Like, it's one of my favorite spaceship designs ever, but it is rubbish. Like, it's a bad spaceship, right? It doesn't make. How did they launch it?
This is what's lovely about, again, the books. If your mind is that way inclined, which mine very much was, learning about this, like the reason why it's so blocky and so like without any element of aerodynamics whatsoever, because it'll never land this huge hulk of a thing. And I really don't want to talk about the books too much because you've had a whole thing on that, but. The book's description of it being like miles and miles and miles long, and the scale of it.
Yeah.
It gives me the shivers even now as I sit sort of decades removed from it.
There's something philosophical to be said about the kind of the sterility of his situation, Lister's situation, an all-male environment. He's the last human in the middle of space, but he's in a castle somehow. I think it is important that he's in such a big thing because he's double dwarfed. He's double tiny. He's double insignificant somehow. Do you know what? We do need to get onto the specific episode. I just had a couple of really quick questions.
Go for it.
Quick fires. Let's call it that. So do you have a favourite episode?
I do like the Waxworld episode because there's a sort of real tragedy to that while also being very funny. Was there a line about Winnie the Pooh either sort of bleeding out or doing a bayonet charge or something
yes.
like that?
Yeah, it's really horrible.
Yeah, so I think that's up there with them. What was the other one? Oh, the Wild West.
Oh, Gunman of the Apocalypse. Lovely stuff. Yes. Yeah.
And I do wonder whether, again, my love for that is because that's really elaborated on in the books.
Mm.
I don't know if it's also because I had one of those VHS collections of like the Smegups, like, oh, here's all the outtakes and here's all the bits, and
there was a bit so about, good
yeah, how difficult it was to get the two bullets to hit each other and to fall to the floor, and so yeah, I don't know if my appreciation of that episode is deepened by the fact that I'd seen the fuss that the production team had to shoot it, but again, it's a lovely little pocket sci-fi idea that's just also sort of drawing on quite like mythic imagery.
That's really, really valid. It is iconic. It's, you're combining two such iconic genre and smashing them together. Was there a point at which, and I know this might be a bit of a downbeat question, and there is a pattern.
The canaries.
Right. Okay. When did you stop watching? And that's the answer. So let's move on. Are you one of the people that's series 7, meh, series 8? No, thank you.
Yeah, I remember getting really excited about it. And I think it's the excitement that stings more than the quality of those episodes. Because it was like, oh God, there's new Red Dwarf. It's coming. Like, oh my God, there's a... Because there'd been a...
There'd been a long gap, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say it felt like a big gap. I couldn't tell whether it was because I was a kid.
No, it was. It was much, much longer than you had before. And also it was coming back on BBC One, if I remember correctly, which made it feel like an even bigger deal.
Yeah, and I thought like, oh, this is great. And oh my God, like they're going to do all these interesting things. And then it felt a little bit tired. I don't know, it didn't quite feel right. And then several years later, when they made the jump to Dave, I tried giving the first episode of that a watch because I thought, oh, let's see what it is. And it felt like something wearing its face. Like it felt like something sort of wrong wearing the face of a loved one. And like Starbug being a little naff car and they were driving around in, I don't know, Emmerdale or something. And
is this Back to Earth, the kind of Series 9 mini-series?
Yeah, I think so. Right? I remember watching a bit of that and just feeling a bit sad.
Can I suggest, make it just a bit of friendly advice, give Series 10, the series after that, a go.
Okay.
It makes me laugh. It adds to the lore. They meet some. They stick to their own patterns. They meet some new people. There's more sci-fi ideas to be done. It's not a patch on your favourite series. but it's worth it. I'm hesitant here because this all comes with the proviso that I watched it while I was really feverish with COVID. So
so just a little bit of delirium.
Yeah, but that helps.
But if you're not enjoying it, Guy, give yourself a second chance. You know, go out to a lot of parties over winter and, you know, try again.
Just get strangers to, like, lick my teeth a bit.
It's worth it. It's Red Dwarf. It's worth it.
I just have one last little general question about Red Dwarf before I hand over to John, who's going to kind of take us through the episode specifically. There's rumours. There's been rumours since the thing started, but there's fresh rumours about a film happening. And the big question is going to be, is it going to be the same four or five leads? Who would you want to see playing Lister and Rimmer?
I've thought about recasting because, like, something to keep in mind with Red Dwarf and, like, in the 80s when it was released, it wasn't a majority white cast. Like, it was, and that's again a sounds weird to say, like, a brave choice for its time, but it kind of was, as well as not having just, like, straight comedy actors. You've got poets, you've got dancers, you've got so on and so forth.
Given how little acknowledgement that gets,
yeah,
it's extraordinary.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, it's almost weird to think of Red Dwarf as that kind of show, but it is. And so I'd obviously want to keep something like that. I really like the idea of Nish Kumar as Rimmer.
Oh my God.
I think he's got such a, like, he can draw on a sort of aggravated pomposity.
Yes.
And, like, I love the man. He's a lovely guy. I'm not saying this to call him a prick.
No, but his Orwellian rants against the Tories on, say, the Bugle podcast, they're chef's kiss. They're incredible. I mean, he's, yeah, so angry.
Yes. I just think, yeah, he could really channel that to sort of present, like, the bitterness and that, like, Rimmer is a pathetic figure. I'm not saying he's got no redeeming features, but he's just such a gutless, miserable little wretch of a man who's so fueled with self-loathing, but also with pomposity. And I think that Nish would give a really lovely sort of turn for that. I just think he'd be able to do the sort of weirdly, almost barely restrained kind of indignation. And I'd love to see him give that a try. As for Lister, I'm not sure. I've not seen much of Guz Khan's stuff.
Oh.
But I can see him going for that. Lister's a tricky one to cast because there's something so Craig Charles about that character that, I don't know, it feels strange to try and put somebody else into those shoes. Do you have any thoughts on who your Lister would be?
No, we're kind of gathering evidence. It's interesting. My theory about Lister, a current Lister, is that we won't have heard of them.
Nice.
Because whoever would end up playing Lister is, it has to be a specific type of everyman that cannot be someone already known to the general public. I don't know, that's a lazy answer, isn't it?
Speculative casting. We've done Rimmer, we've done Lister, kind of. Who's next? Cat? Have you got a cat in mind, Guy?
I think Cat is really difficult, because either you want somebody who's like a big bruiser tomcat, or you want somebody really live and, like, sexy and cool and ridiculous. I don't know. I think something from, like, the crop of clowns that we have. It's out there, but maybe, like, Elf Lyons as Cat. Those of you that don't know, Elf Lyons, lovely performer, clown, general sort of onstage weirdo. And I think that would be, like, an interesting turn.
Yeah, a little more androgyny as well might help that character somehow. I don't know why I think that.
Speaking of, in a way, you're Holly. Would you go the Hattie route or the Norman route?
I like the idea of Bob Mortimer as Holly.
That's great, yeah.
Because I think regional accents are important for that show. Obviously, he was supposed to be, like, the Holly in the book. Stop it, Guy. I just get a bell every time I say the book. Like, it details, you know, the description of him as a sort of very London kind of accent. Just to be a horrendous name dropper, one of the highlights of my comedy career was I was doing a gig on the same bill as Norman Lovett.
Ooh.
And getting into the green room and actual Holly sitting there looking up at us as we come in and going, "All right, dudes. Stop it." But yeah, I think
nice.
Bob Mortimer would have a really sort of pleasing inbuilt weirdness to it, because he is just an odd man. And I think that would really lend itself to this great, tremendous intellect that's just gone stagnant over 3 million years of outrageous loneliness.
That's great casting. That's lovely.
And with maybe Matt Berry as Queeg, we're not quite there yet, but if we did a Queeg episode with a Matt Berry as that kind of booming voice.
Do we have any ideas on Crichton? I know we haven't met Crichton yet in the chronology of the podcast, but...
Crichton, I've for a while I thought that Richard Ayoade would be a good Crichton. I think there's...
just something about that very particular voice that he uses that I think brought back a little bit would be ideal for Crichton.
Like just that voice trying to say Smeghead and failing to do it would be lovely.
Yeah, that's really nice. John, I think it's time for you to take us into the episode itself.
Right. Let me briefly recap Red Dwarf, the end, which is the beginning of Red Dwarf, which is the end of Red Dwarf, which is almost where our story begins, but not quite. So let's begin at the beginning of the end, which is the beginning of the end. I really like how they've called the first episode the end. It's very clever. We open on, I think, Lister in a spacesuit, painting the name on a massive spaceship, the mighty Red Dwarf. Maintenance techs Lister and Rimmer are each convinced the other is insufferable. Perhaps Lister can bear it because if Officer Todhunter is anything to go by, everyone agrees Rimmer is a smeghead. A disgusting insult. We'll hear a lot. A funeral. The music, as George McIntyre's ashes are blasted into space. See you later, alligator. What a totally inappropriate choice. Why is nobody saying? We find Lister and Rimmer are not only work frenemies, but also bunk nemeses. They want a better life. Rimmer by finally passing the astro-engineering exam, Lister by spending all of his pay to buy a farm on flooded Fiji. McIntyre's wake has an unexpected guest for the viewer. It's the dead guy. George is very relaxed about having been brought back as a hologram. It's a lucky break. The ship can only sustain one hologram, apparently. Prob's not important. What is important? Lister has smuggled a cat on board, Frankenstein. She's pregnant. And nobody has told her not to look at the camera. While Rimmer spectacularly fails his exam, Lister refuses to tell Captain Hollister where he's hidden the cat, and he's sentenced to 18 months in stasis, a state of suspended animation, where time has no effect because sci-fi. Ship's computer Holly releases him, 3 million years late. Turns out Rimmer messed up some repairs, subjecting everyone on board to a lethal dose of cadmium 2. Only now is it safe for humans to walk the corridors. Lister is gutted. His secret crush, Kachansky, is gone. I mean, they're all gone. Everybody's dead, Dave. But Holly has revived one crew member as a hologram. Unfortunately for Lister, but most fortunately indeed for comedy, it's Rimmer. And somehow, they're not alone. A besuited, bequiffed and befanged bloke is here looking better than nice. He's a descendant of Frankenstein, an evolved cat. Lister decides to take the cat home. Meet the new plan, same as the old plan. Holly, plot a course to Fiji. Freeze frame, legend. The beginning. And that is the end of the Precy. And this is the beginning of our chat about the first episode of Red Dwarf.
When you put it like that, there's a lot going on in this episode.
A hell of a lot. They fit it all into that first 29 minutes, don't they?
I think we should start at the very beginning, our first vision of the magnificent Red Dwarf. How do you guys think this holds up 35 years later?
I think it's magical. I really do. There was a tweet by a lovely comic book artist, Jamie Smart, and he was rewatching Red Dwarf, and he talked about the starkness of that image. The music is incredibly somber, like it's funereal. One man on his own, again, presumably Lister, like made tiny by the vastness of Red Dwarf, which is in itself made tiny by the vastness of the universe. It's, apart from the sort of the music, it's silent. There's no like, we are all on a spaceship, it is a spooky time. Like there's nothing. It's just lonely. And it's a really bold choice to start a comedy show.
It's doom laden, right? You do not think you are going to get laughs after that opening, right?
Yeah, and it's magical.
What's amazing about it, given the tone that it sets, and I agree, it is there's something really quite magnificent about it, isn't there? And this sense that you're going to be moved. I think it says a lot for the performances that within seconds you are laughing, properly belly laughing, the minute you meet these guys. It's just perfectly played for me, this scene. You get the dynamic of the two of them instantly.
Yeah. just immediately sets up everything you need to know about these two characters.
Fergus, I think when you first watched this, didn't you say that you basically knew you were going to love the show from the minute that Rimmer first speaks?
I don't know now, because obviously I've seen that moment so many times, I might have created the false kind of catalyst memory. But honestly, I was like 9. I'd probably had like a friend at school singing to me annoying, or I'd been singing at a friend to annoy them at school that day or something like that. And just the way he goes, Lister, is so laden. You know straight away that's a guy that's trying to assert status generally in his life, but particularly over this person who clearly doesn't care about his status.
And the follow-up to it is so over the top. Lister, have you ever been hit over the head with a welding mallet? I mean, it just says everything about the lack of power that this guy has in this situation. It's so incredibly extreme. Lister's completely nonchalant reaction to it. You just know everything you need to know about the two of them immediately. It's so well played.
Every line in that scene sort of carries weight. Like, every line in that scene does something to further establish and really bed in the fact that one guy is incredibly up himself, thinks really highly of himself, really lowly of all others, can never be wrong, and is just, if only the world would give him a chance. And the other guy sees through that completely and takes great delight in picking that apart whenever. And it's just everything they do and say builds to this and adds to this. That as an introduction to a comedy show goes, that's such a solid, like, these are what these characters are. You like this, you're in luck.
Just a quick straw poll. When you guys saw the episode for the first time, did you get the derivation of Smeg?
Nope. I'm a pure and innocent soul. I assumed it was from the sort of great tradition of British sci-fi pretend swears, like your Judge Dredd's Drock and so on and so forth.
Yeah. Well, that the Battlestar Galactica remake had a lot of frack in it, didn't it?
I think that's why they get away with Smeghead and Smegubs and a Smegazine under the BBC banner, because I don't think anyone clocked it.
I absolutely knew what it was at the age of 9.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
I think it depends how recently you'd had your sex education.
At 9, I'd hope I'd had none.
I think the reason that, like, my brain to this day still pushes back against the connection is that I don't think anyone's ever in the history of mankind thought, I know what we need to do. We need a cutesy contraction of smegma. Like, that word needs to be a little bit smaller and just a little bit cheeky.
Rob Grant and Doug Naylor did.
I don't think that's a thing.
What, you don't think Grant and Naylor were doing that deliberately? Do you think it's a coincidence?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely is, but I just kind of can't quite bring myself to...
It would ruin it for you. Okay, that's enough smegma for one episode, I think. I'm sure it'll be back.
But Robert Bathurst, he's in Toaster London. He's a proper actor, he's big.
Was he a proper actor when this happened?
Can't have been. I think his heyday was after this.
Yeah, that would make sense, yeah. Imagine getting it... No, don't. I'm going to take us down a pointless... sidetrack there, trying to imagine what super famous people you could cast in the role of Todd Hunter. What is the point of that as a discussion?
I don't know that it's completely redundant though, John. There is a thing about casting, right? That's I find this fascinating, that Alan Rickman was asked to read for Rimmer and he said, no, can I do Lister instead?
You are a Smeghead.
And then, as Alex corrected me recently, Alfred Molina was going to be the Rimmer until Grant and Naylor kind of realised that they could have these awesomely well-known and respected actors in it, but there's no way they'll sign on for longer than one series.
Yeah, I mean, can you imagine Craig Charles as Hans Gruber facing up against Bruce Willis?
I would like to see that, actually.
Yeah, who wouldn't now that the idea exists, yeah.
But how interesting, I think, that maybe Rickman saw Lister as being more a more interesting character on the page, where, actors correct me, Rimmer's the juicier role, right?
Yeah, the barely restrained fury that he knows deep down he needs to direct it himself.
The self-loathing that comes out later on, it's extraordinary.
Is that something inherently British?
Self-loathing? I don't think it's exclusive to British people, but we do use it in comedy a lot, don't we? Seemingly a lot more than... other countries do.
Seemingly the natural British urge to like undercut yourself. I don't know how much like into the weeds of the American pilot you want to get onto.
Please.
Yeah, just the in the American pilot, something that fascinated me was the scene with the hologram, who like he sort of introduces himself as like, the only thing I can touch is myself, so my sex life hasn't changed. And that felt like a little bit of a kind of a Seinfeld-y kind of a gag. Whereas the gag that lives in that same spot in the British one is him saying, I can only touch myself, so I'm not a threat to your marriages anymore. And, Eric knows what I'm talking about, don't you? There's a cheekiness to that, like the inherent cheekiness of the Welsh. But it's like, again, the difference between it's a masturbation joke, and the audience is like, ooh, masturbation. Whereas this is like, don't worry, guys, I'm not going to fuck your wives anymore.
The American version, that's as close to self-deprecating as they're going to get.
Yeah.
And it's not actually.
And it's probably even deeper than that, isn't it? It's not so much that we believe that McIntyre is a player, so much as that we all laugh in recognition of the fact that we all fear being cuckolded.
I think like the thing I loved about that line is like, there's someone who's no longer a threat to your marriages. And then Joe knows what I'm talking about. And it just cuts to a guy who, like, he's clearly being cuckolded by this dead dude.
He's laughing, and then a woman next to him, who's frankly sitting too far away from him to be his partner, elbows him in the side, and he looks apologetic. I've never really understood that moment, if I'm going to be completely honest.
Speaking of bizarre moments, and the funeral for this guy, as See You Later, Alligator plays, there's a scutter dancing, which, you know, that adds to the character of the scutters. There's also one guy in the background just having a little boogie to himself, and I think that's a fascinating choice.
That is a weird choice. The weirdest choice is on the director's part, to have not gone, I'm sorry, love, just Dave at the back there, yes, that lovely energy, but would you mind, read the room, maybe?
It's almost like they don't trust the audience to get that See You Later, Alligator was a funny choice of song for a funeral.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So a little detail that I noticed, again, just going through sort of with a notebook and pen, when Lister wishes Rimmer good luck for his exam, Lister means it. Like, it's a sincere.
He really does.
Like, it's a genuine and sincere good luck. And Rimmer can't even take that. Like, he's such a vile little prick that this genuine and sincere thing, which you'd think if that comes from somebody who's been like getting on your nerves for the past X month, and like you're constantly back and forth and like bite, 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 you'd think that would mean more. And I don't think that was a flippant or a glib or like a stab of a good luck. It came across like Lister meant it. Lister was genuinely and sincerely wishing this guy well. And Rimmer lacks the fundamental decency to even acknowledge that.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Coming back to that, is Lister cool or not? You know, Lister, the guy who hasn't bought socks or deodorant for years, who sticks a cigarette in his ear, etc., spills the milk everywhere when he feeds the cat. He works with the guy, he lives with the guy, like centimetres away from him on a bunk bed, and yet he wears it so lightly, the irritation that Lister takes from Rimmer, whereas Rimmer cannot let anything go. And that's one of the things I think that brings Lister back down on the side of, no, this guy's cool.
Yes, absolutely. He's also, it's nice that the last human is so human.
Yeah.
Right? He does mean it. You've hit the nail on the head, guy. That it's such a well-written pilot. Every single exchange between them tells you everything you need to know about their individual characters and their relationship. That's
when they're heading to the funeral, Rimmer has got Lister's jacket, goes to hand it to him and just drops it on the floor. And it's such a petty prick move.
So small.
But again, yeah, like that compared to Lister's quite sincere, you know, good luck with it. It's just,
This is the first time Craig Charles has acted, right? I'm pretty sure he'd obviously done performance poetry, but he hadn't played a character before, I don't think.
Yeah, and Chris Barry hadn't done that much on the screen. He'd done a lot of voices for kind of, there was a very early video game that he did, something, The Wizard, where he played The Wizard.
Oh, yes, that rings a bell.
Yeah, and then he did some Spitting Image. And so, yeah, I think none of them were particularly experienced. I love Red Dwarf, but it's okay to be a fan and critique stuff, right, that you love.
It's important to. You can't truly love something without analysing its or examining its weaknesses and making your peace with it.
Thanks, man. Because that's exactly what I'm going to do here. It's. But again, I think it's a director note, and I Ed Bye is a bit of a hero of mine. But still, no one had told Craig Charles that he doesn't have to play the comedy on every line. So when he says that I'm going to have a dog and a cat and breed horses, Craig Charles. Just before the cutaway, there's just a moment where you see Craig Charles doing that. Oh, hang on, I've said something silly. And then it cuts to Rimmer going, haven't you just said something silly? It's such a small thing, but, you know, if we're going granular, if someone had just told him, Craig, you can't, it's like in D&D, right? You can't be the hero of every... Let's definitely cut that reference.
Yeah, God forbid you sound nerdy on your Red Dwarf fan podcast. Good grief.
About being nerdy about the right things. There's a couple. They get ironed out. Clearly, Ed Bye sat him down and went, listen, man, like the way this, you have to play the truth of it. And if you're doing, like, watch Leslie Nielsen in Airplane, do that. Don't try and let the audience know what the joke is.
And I tell you what I think is absolutely fantastic acting from Craig Charles in this. And I think it must be coming from him because I don't see how you could really script it, or at least you certainly couldn't script it as he performed it. But when he realises that Kachansky's dead and he's looking at the ashes in that place and he just does that, it's very Liverpudlian. He's like, oh, eh? Like, you couldn't have scripted that. But he just, it's heartbreaking because it's so underplayed, but you just get his heart breaking in that moment. It's lovely, lovely bit of acting.
I was thinking yesterday watching that sequence, the Everybody's Dead Dave sequence, as he walks through, you know, taking little fingerfuls of ash of what turns out to be his former crewmates, as Holly just repeats, everybody's dead, Dave. Dave, everybody's dead. Not Kachansky, everybody, Dave. And just that for like a minute.
Yeah.
And as well as being very funny, that's like when you have that sort of, you step back and you think about it, like this, what an impossible thing to process.
Yeah.
And you would say like, everybody's dead. Surely not Peterson. Surely not Seth. Like, sure. Oh, no, but not this. Because that's the biggest news anyone could feasibly have. Like, you're the last surviving member of the human. Everybody's dead. And yeah, that's obviously then undercut by the insistence of Holly and the funny ways he sort of tries to get that information across. But God, what a dark thing.
That insistence is cruel. I think Holly gets to that exasperation a little too quickly. Ah. Oh, I've been saying it three times already, and I know you've just come out of stasis for 3 million years, but listen. I don't know. I think there's a lot.
Yeah, I've got a note here just saying it. I think it really shows how much Holly slipped over the years, that he doesn't have that.
No bedside manner.
Yeah, the understanding that you need to do this gently and not just repeat, everybody's dead, Dave. Everybody. Everybody's dead.
But then explain to me the Gordon Bennett. Gordon Bennett, yes, Dave.
I think it's because he's been waiting for 3 million years to be able to have a conversation again. And finally it's happening. And he's just having to say the same thing over and over and over again. And it's not, although it's a horrifying concept to grasp, it's a pretty straightforward fact. Everybody's dead. How else can you interpret that other than literally?
Is Holly a sociopath?
No, he's just gone a bit funny after 3 million years, which gives rise to my favourite line in the whole episode, which I have barely laughed at every single time that I've watched it. Coming back to the Kachansky moment where Lister eventually gets it together and says, oh, she was going to come with me to Fiji. I hadn't told her yet. And Holly's response to that is, she wouldn't be much use to you on Fiji now. Not unless it snows and you need something to grit the path with.
But also, I remember having to ask my parents what the word insurmountable meant. even if she was alive, the age difference would be insurmountable. I went, what's that mean? And they told me, and then I laughed. It's amazing. There's so much going on in that sequence. Can we talk about the fact that it is revealed in that very downbeat and doom-laden moment that Rimmer killed the crew?
Yeah.
It is explicit in the script, but it's never said explicitly. The context of it is this: is Lister waking up and coping with the 3 million years everyone dead
thing. Yeah, Rimmer didn't fix the drive plate properly.
And then Rimmer blaming that when he's brought back as the hologram, blaming it on Lister because Lister wasn't there to help him with it. He's still like, this was somebody else's fault.
Oh, yeah.
This man who literally existed out of time, it's his fault, not me.
Rimmer killed 168 people, including himself.
Oh, actually, while we're here, can I just really quickly, because this is not a complete tangent, but the iPlayer description of this episode reads, the mining ship Red Dwarf is an old tramp steamer working around the moons of Saturn. It is 5 miles long and 3 miles wide, with a crew of 169. Within 24 hours, 168 of them will be dead.
God, well, if you made it to the end of that extremely tedious description, you might want to watch it.
iPlayer, have you seen Red Dwarf? Do you know what Red Dwarf is? Did anyone say comedy to you? That's weird. I'm not. It's not just me, right? That's an odd one.
All of that is weird. All of that is. I mean, it's a good hook right at the end, but why do you have to wade through so much maths? There's a prospective viewer out there somewhere that's going to be satisfied by going, right, it's 5 miles long. Okay, good, because I won't watch any sci-fi sitcoms where the ship is any shorter than 4.75 miles. So I will continue. Thanks, BBC.
They've got all the really important information in there. I think that's the good thing. Can I talk about the fact that there's so much packed into this episode, as we've talked about already? We've established what a crazy amount of character and story and setup and awesomeness and context and lovely stuff. And even in the background, it's not necessarily great writing, but when Hollister says, like, don't you remember what happened on the Oregon with the rabbits? They're clearly thinking about world building, the Jupiter Mining Corporation. These are cool sounding things in the periphery of this episode. And yet, there is a 3 minute scene running from 6:29 to 9:29 where Rimmer and Lister are in their bunks talking about, yes, Rimmer's exam and Lister's plan, but it's a 3 minute scene. In a pilot where they're cramming stuff in, they let 3 minutes for that scene. What's going on there, guys?
I love the scene. I love it. I love the bit about Lister's plan. I think there's it's so rich with gags, like the sheep and a cow and breed horses. No, with horses and horses. But the thing about the rising sea levels, it's only 3 feet. They can wade. Like, there's a real fool's optimism to that. Mm. And I think, like, fundamentally, Lister is an optimistic character. He has to be hopeful because he's the last living human.
Mm.
And if that sort of core of optimism broke, that would be it for him. It's not sheer idiocy of it's only 3 feet they can wade, but it's a real sense of like, oh, I'll be all right. We'll fix it. Something will come up. She'll be right.
Is that the same? Is his line, the sheep are going to have to be quite tall? Like, again, there's a the word quite is so perfect in that sentence. Do you know what else? Like, while we're talking about performance, the lads. I think Red Dwarf is really good at not being too laddish, given its maleness. But the lads, Chen, Selby, Peterson, and Lister, I find their bants and their stuff quite affecting and quite natural, quite realistic. I buy into it. Even though it's contrived, it feels like those characters contrived the stuff that they do rather than it being contrived by a writer and forcing a bunch of actors to do it. Like when at the end of the scene, when Rimmer gets out his notepad to write Lister up and they all go, ooh, like it feels very real to me. I have done the Peterson coin on the forehead trick to someone and it worked.
Yep.
Go on, guy. You tell us about your experience.
Oh, no, no. Sorry. I wasn't trying to cut you off. That was just me excitedly like, yep, I've just, yeah, done it and it's worked. And it's a charming thing.
It's a delight. And that's the only reason it's in there, right? Is to let the audience know that it does work so you can go and do it on your friends who haven't seen the episode.
I was just going to say, I love that he, when they're applauding McIntyre's return speech as a hologram, it cuts away to the wide shot and Peterson, rather than clapping, is taking this as an opportunity to just continue smacking the back of his head to see if he can get the coin off.
In my mind, all the way through, he was still just smacking himself.
We haven't talked about the cat yet. So we should probably just quickly give it up for Danny John-Jules' magnificent performance.
My first note about Cat is the weird muted trumpets when the cat appears. Like, I did not remember that. Like, a real kind of vaudeville, like, real mutes on those trumpets giving it a...
It turns out the bright upbeat theme tune at the end of the episode is Cat's theme, not Lister and Rimmer's. That's the music we hear when the cat comes out. It's bam, 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 ba, ba, da, sleek and slinky. He's awesome. Does he play a cat? Like, he's very vain. He's hypersexualized.
Well, you're the owner of... Sorry, you're the father...
Owner
operator. You're the owner. Thank you're the owner of two cats, not the father. Is he playing a cat?
He's not playing my cats. Insofar as he's not lazy and violent. But, I guess one of the things is that Cat isn't attention starved, and that is I think something that his capriciousness, yes, the narcissism, that's something you can put on Cat, certainly. So yeah, he is a cat. I think the character narrowed a little bit as the series went on.
Yes,
but that can be the character growth. He's been hanging out with two humans of very different types,
and he clearly knows something of human civilization already. I mean, it's very weird, and I'm pretty sure it's never explained in subsequent episodes how Cat civilization learnt the song Me and My Shadow, why they speak English, why he's got a wardrobe full of loud suits, why he knows what a monkey is. But it's all great. I don't really care. But as far as I know, they don't ever explain any of that, right? He's presumably just been watching videos somewhere.
I think it might specifically be Flintstones videos. And again, I don't know if that's from the book. Oh, God, I'm saying it again. But I'm sure there's something about... I know there's the wonderful, like, gag about Wilma and Betty Flintstone that comes, like, way later in the series. But I'm sure there is something about, like, learning English.
Oh, that's right, there is.
Watching old Flintstones videos.
Oh, there we go, yeah. Right, well, that's half answered my question. And yeah, there are videos and things around.
I got the impression there was a whole evolutionary culture that grew up and then faded away again. An empire on the ship.
I like that in itself as an idea is just magical. Like 3 million years have happened, an entire civilization has risen and fallen in the cargo hold of a spaceship.
Yeah.
And then they've gone out, they've become a spacefaring people in and of themselves to fight. Like, yum, 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 yum. Just lovely stuff.
I'm getting genuine chills off you saying that. But yes, it's awesome. Anytime you step back from Red Dwarf, whenever you take a step back from the jokes, it's easy to become a little overwhelmed by the actual context, the actual setting, the situation that Lister's in.
Yeah, the deliberate choice to not have aliens. Everything that, like, Lister is alone, and all of the problems that he encounters are from humans. Like, all the monsters he finds, all the, like, deranged robots, all of this is of a human doing.
Yeah.
There's almost like an accountability to that, yeah, which is kind of an opposite to Rimmer's complete lack of self-accountability. He says that, you know, the universe is against him. There's always something and something is stopping him. Whereas Lister, again, you know, if you can't pass first time fair and square, why bother? He's ultimately like, he knows he's a slob, but he owns that. That's who I am. He's got a small sort of set of plans. And I think, yeah, there's something quite powerful about the fact that every adversary is like intrinsic to humanity, rather than like, oh no, aliens are happening now. Oh, horrors unknown. No, we can make plenty of our own horrors. We got loads of that.
We've just talked about some moments that maybe don't make sense, but there's one question, Guy, that we want to ask absolutely everybody, every guest that we have. You are privileged to be the first.
The trendsetter.
What that's me. Is the best moment in this episode?
It's a close-run thing for me. I really like the chat about the plan. As we mentioned, sheep and a cow and breed horses is just a lovely line. I think the best bit is where Lister's been brought up in front of the captain, where he shows that he knows about the cat. He's had a photo taken. I don't think we got really into like Lister's plan for what the cat is and why that existed, but we've had a lot to cover. Mm. What are they going to do when they find the cat? Well, they'll dissect it, make sure there's no threat to the ship. Will they put it back together when they're done? No, Lister. And then Lister says, with respect, sir, what's in it for the cat? And that's lovely. It's a like it's a hilarious line. It's a great line, like from a characterization standpoint. It's showing that he's protecting this delicate small thing. It's showing that he can talk to authority without being immediately dismissive of it, but also that he will. I mean, obviously, part of the plan was to get put into stasis because he didn't want to spend any more time doing Red Dwarf stuff. He just wanted to get back to Earth. But the fact that he cares for this creature's well-being, and it's just hilarious with respect to what's in it for the cat.
That is a great line.
Yeah, it's on the board. Great, great choice, Guy. And thank you so much for giving us so much of your time. This episode of the podcast should probably be called Let's Be Honest. What a guy.
No, I'm so happy to have been here. Yeah, really looking forward to seeing where you folks go with this and, hearing what you and what your guests have to say about the coming episodes. I genuinely can't wait.
If we're lucky enough to continue, please come back. And
I'll be delighted.
Pick an episode, your fave.
Oh, I've got a good 10-minute diatribe about what I want from a Red Dwarf point-and-click adventure game, like in the style of Day of the Tentacle.
Ooh.
Honestly, And I'll just be saying this to my cats if I'm not doing it on mic, so at least it'll go somewhere.
Now, I'm sure the listeners have absolutely loved getting to know your Red Dwarf obsession, Guy, but if they want more Guy Kelly, where can they find you?
Gosh, I'm all over the shop. Twitter and Blue Sky at BrainMage. I stream Cryptic Crosswords on twitch.tv/BrainMage. You don't have to know how cryptics work to watch that. I barely know how they work. I think most of the fun is watching me suffer. And finally, if you enjoyed listening to me talking about something that I enjoy and really love, then you'll get a great kick out of me talking about something I don't particularly care for when you listen to I Don't Like Mondays, the unedited husband and wife Garfield review podcast I make with my wife. Neither of us particularly care for Garfield, and we've decided that one strip per episode, we should review every single Garfield strip. We're about 300 years away from being finished if we keep churning them out one a week. It's better than it sounds, I promise. Oh, you can also see some pictures that I've taken. I've recently gotten into taking and selling prints of my photographs because it turns out the secret to fine art photography is autism, and you can find that on hyperfocus.photography.
Guy Kelly, thank you for coming on the podcast. Was it better than life?
Oh, infinitely so.
Oh, that was awesome. Guy Kelly, thank you so much. That was brilliant. Where didn't we go with that chat? Well, we're about to find out.
We are. He was such a good first guest. So good. Like, just, he's really set a bar. He's got a Mr. Flibble puppet. How many subsequent guests are going to have their own hand puppet?
Yeah, that's interesting. I suspect a lot are going to be referring to the books. I think that's just the kind of literary gang comedians tend to be.
Very highbrow, yes, yes.
What didn't we cover?
There's a handful of very small things. I mean, from the comprehensive notes that I made before this episode. Okay, here's one. And I bet this is one that we didn't cover for a very good reason, which is that nobody else thought of it. Something I really enjoyed seeing. George McIntyre's funeral. There's a little Welsh flag on the tube containing his ashes. And I really liked just that reassuring hint that the country of Wales still exists in the far future. It's not been absorbed into some sort of UKIP nightmare. It's still out there. Unless the flag is like a sort of Confederacy kind of, you know, symbol of a lost past, but without the
embarrassing
the white supremacist overturn.
So yeah, faintly awkward for all the British people there. Could you go a step further? Could Wales have seceded? Could it be its own nation?
It's possible, isn't it? But, I mean, in the real world, I don't see it happening. But is this the podcast to discuss that? No. But yes, in an imaginary future, sure, it could. Yeah, why not? Out of pure exasperation if we don't. Oh, no. That's going into a realm that we just shouldn't touch.
McIntyre's still got the accent, right?
Yeah.
It's a Welsh accent. The Welsh flag is honouring him, I assume.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's how I read it, yeah.
It's still around, unless there was one other Welsh guy on the squad. There's only 169 of them, and if it's as international as Grant Naylor wanted it to be, then there's only really room for one Welshman, I think.
Absolutely. There'll be trilingual signs now, so you have the English, the Welsh, and the Esperanto all over the place.
They put an American in charge, though. That's something we didn't talk about a huge amount. Like, that's probably important.
Yeah, some things don't change, I guess.
I remember really disliking Mac McDonald's performance when I first saw it.
Oh, interesting.
It's not his performance, it's the character. And it's the fact that in sitcoms, there's always someone who ruins the fun. 99% of sitcoms have a fun ruiner, a rule follower who seems to be there. I think some writers confuse that with being a straight person, like the butt of the joke, but that exasperation at someone else's naughtiness or ridiculousness, I don't know. Sitcoms don't need that character. And I maybe identified Captain McAllister as being that.
Yeah.
Turns out he's not. Turns out he's actually just still being really funny. And actually, I don't think Red Dwarf has that character. Even Rimmer or Crichton or Holly, all the people except Lister, who should be quite downer in terms of rule following, they cause absolute mayhem.
I think I had that problem with Marge on The Simpsons. Do you think Hollister's sort of enveloping the Crichton role in the earlier series?
It's all about perspective, right? Like, coming back to Red Dwarf as a grown-up and going, oh, no, he's really funny. Marge can be funny. There's some episodes like her gambling addiction episode.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it in a while. Maybe it's aged poorly.
I do appreciate that he doesn't try and create a comedy character. He's playing it quite straight. And I can imagine there'd be a temptation to go, oh, I'm going to be, you know, do some sort of wacky thing with it because I'm in this one episode and then I pop back up later. You're like, well, how can I make an impact? Give him a crazy futuristic eye patch that changes colour or something. That would involve props, wouldn't it? But, you know, some sort of wild accent or something.
No, he's still got a little pot of pens on his desk, which is just off that really little bridge. Maybe it's the writing. Maybe, because I can't think, again, we mentioned this in the episode, but I can't think of anyone who doesn't absolutely suit and fill the role that they play.
Yeah, that's true.
Including all the small parts. Is that the writing? Or it's almost as if the writers, as if it was devised with the actors in mind.
Yeah. Well, we talked about the energy of the Lister's mates, didn't we? But yeah, that's definitely got that feeling, hasn't it?
Yeah. Maybe that's what I meant when I said realistic. I just meant, yeah, you could buy it. We didn't mention the fact that Mark Williams is amongst them.
Oh, yes.
Probably the most famous cast member in Red Dwarf.
Yeah, probably true, yeah.
For people under 30? People who haven't watched the Far Show but do like Harry Potter.
Yeah, Peterson's a lovely character as well.
I'm glad he's the one they bring back in later episodes. If only his forearm.
Yes, and we see him again when they go through the hole in time, right? And he's trying to chat up to ladies. No spoilers.
Is he successful?
As one of those people under 30, probably, there's something quite sort of wholesome and bumbling about his character, which does feel like Mr. Weasley.
Ah, really?
Right. Yeah. Interesting.
But he still comes across as... I always found him quite Danish. I don't know why. Just imagining a beer was never far away from his hand.
That feels authentic to the character, yeah, for sure.
What a sweeping generalisation.
Yeah. Well, he's Scandinavian and he clearly enjoys a drink. I mean, they all do.
Yeah.
And you don't get the impression any of them take their jobs that seriously. You know, they're not here to go up the ziggurat, lickety-split, are they, any of them?
You wonder how they got on board in the first place. They kind of interviewed well.
No, that's true. I mean, that's reassuring for the future as well, isn't it? Because they're all doing jobs that you might imagine now would be replaced by AI, but clearly not. They're not. The robots are not sorting out the suit. Even though there are robots that do stuff like that, for some reason the Scutters can't fix the soup dispensers.
Well, they've only got three fingers.
That's a design flaw, isn't it? I mean,
they can flick the Vs as superior officers, but they can't put a 14B up a soup nozzle.
Yeah, but more to the point, they can build a spaceship the size of a city, but they can't create a service droid that can mimic a human hand. Maybe there's a law in the future that stops them. It'll be like some sort of EU directive where it's like, okay, if we allow people to create service droids with human hands, then we're all going to be out of a job. I mean, not us EU bureaucrats, but...
Assuming that human hands are the best possible design of hands. which they cannot be, let's be honest.
They are the best we've got. Don't knock nature / God. That's it's got us from the trees, the plains of Africa. It's got us all the way from that to weapons with which we could annihilate each other in seconds.
I think you've pinpointed something very interesting about the future. Rob Grant wrote a book called Incompetence. I think he believes in a kind of idiocracy.
Mm.
It's almost unfair injustice when they pin, like, Rimmer can't be blamed for not fixing the drive plate properly, causing the leak that kills everyone in episode one. It's not just because he couldn't possibly have had that authority. It's surely also that in the future, like, look at the state of Red Dwarf in the first place. It was doomed. It's doomed. They have robots that can't fix soup nuzzles. They employ, well, let's be honest, wastrels.
Yes.
And roustabouts.
A crew of 169, of whom one is Rimmer. I mean, that's one too many Rimmers, surely. I'll tell you what, actually, another thing we didn't talk about, it's such a small thing, but this relates to Rimmer. When he signs his exam paper, the signature is just so perfect. It's like this little coiled up worm of tension. It's the most repressed looking signature you've ever seen in your life. It's just brilliant.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was Chris Barry's actual hand or they got a specialist signature actor in to do it.
I thought it was I assumed it was a performative flourish. I reckon he'd done that. I reckon he'd practiced it a few times.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely a statement.
It just looks like V's.
Yes.
Like it's really jagged. And so if we apply graphology to Rimmer's signature, then blimey, O'Reilly, he needs assistance, I guess.
He really does. Although on the other hand, he's an open book, isn't he? You could get everything you could get from that signature. You would immediately go, uh-huh. The minute he walked into your analyst's room, you'd just be like, oh yeah. I'm a good graphologist because you're exactly as coiled up and self-loathing as your signature suggests.
Yeah, well, that signature is at the centre of something we didn't talk about a huge amount in the episode, which is the whole exam sequence is so well performed. Everything that Rimmer does in that, from writing his answers all over his body, like, how is he ever going to read something off his calf during an exam, do you know what I mean? Like, come on, man. So the thinking behind it anyway. But then, I don't know, we mentioned telegraphing a little bit. You know what's going to happen.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
But it's still so enjoyable to watch. His face, the zeal on his face just before he passes out. That grin.
Yeah.
I don't think we ever see Rimmer do that face again.
Yeah.
Ever.
It's almost like that salute is just this little, well, listen, I know I'm going to fail this. But look at that. Look how well I did that. You're the ones missing out.
I don't know. I don't know that he thinks he's going to fail. I think at that point his brain is
you think he's living in a whole different reality. Yeah, maybe. I like that.
Just the energy being put into completely the wrong thing as well. Like, yes. Instead of actually studying, he's just spent all his time writing on himself.
Yes. Yeah.
That's a delightful irony, frankly. Yeah,
that is Rimmer, isn't it? He's just spent his whole life with really clear goals, but channeling his energy into exactly the wrong ways of achieving them in just about every aspect of his life.
Yeah,
he works so hard at doing the wrong thing all the time, and then it's always someone else's fault. Did you notice the look on his face right at the end of the episode when Lister says, look out, Earth, the slime's coming home, and then we get the freeze frame? And it's so interesting, the choice that Chris Barry's made in that moment, because there's so many different things that Rimmer could be thinking about the prospect of them returning home, but he just looks utterly disgusted with Lister and this whole scenario. He's the one person brought back. There's 167 other people that could have been brought back. He's there, and he's just so disgusted.
Chris Barry gives great freeze frame.
He really does.
And that you can see a lot in that. What's he disgusted at? Not going home, surely.
No, it's...
Or are we seeing a deep-rooted disgust at the idea that he would ever see his family again? Or or is it disgust at the fact that he has to spend that time with this life?
I think that's what it is, yeah. I mean, he seems pretty convinced that there's nobody left anyway, that Earth is... That's where the slime thing comes from, isn't it? He's basically suggested that humanity will be over and done with by the time they get back anyway.
Or it could be as simple as that insult switched. Like, he wanted to insult Lister, and Lister has embraced the word and reclaimed it for his own.
Yes, actually, yeah, no, that could be it. Actually, it's like, oh God, what's the, that's a foretaste of things to come. He's going to be even slobbier. He's going to be even worse to live with. Yeah, maybe that's it. Actually, I like that.
I just want to mention one thing.
Yeah.
Before we stop talking about this extraordinary episode, I have a feeling we're going to talk about it in future episodes. It's the moment when Rimmer calls Todd Hunter. He says, "Ah, you big leg."
Oh yeah. Yeah, what is that? Yeah.
The script, the kind of transcripts of the script say, "You big lig."
Which makes no sense. I mean, it is a term, right, for basically going, swanning around town, going to free parties, right?
I have a weird feeling that word came about. That word had its heyday in the early 90s, a few years after.
Yes, oh yeah, God, no, I don't think it relates to that because it wouldn't make any sense in that context.
No, it sounds like he was going to say something else. Bootlicker. And got the
the
way around. Yeah, like, you know. Or we could ascribe it to Grant and Naylor's habit of just trying a little insult out. Smeghead stuck.
Yep.
Liga.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, we get gimboid for a bit, don't we? But I don't think that lasts. Goit as well.
The two G's have multiple uses. There are some we're going to come to this series, I think, that just get one.
Yeah.
Modo.
Oh, right, yeah.
Come up.
Yeah.
Anyway. That spoilers for future episodes.
If you're only listening for the insults, now you might as well stop.
Well, maybe we should all stop listening, John. I think it's time. Well, that's enough chat about episode one, isn't it? We've been thorough. No one can take that away from us.
Sorry, I stopped listening. What?
you're just following orders too precisely.
I am.
Come back next time for episode two. We're going to be talking about Future Echoes with the awesome Beck Hill.
Oh, yes.
That is not to be missed.
See you then.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.